You're listening to Stories About People.
This story is called A Date with Time by Chris Ward.
I'll be back from my date in 2 minutes, I called out to my housemate, donning a shirt and buttoning it to the collar. I heard an indiscriminate grunt of acknowledgement and consulted my shoe collection to pick out something that was a suitable balance of casual and smart and that wouldn't look out of place. This was my third date with Jane, and things were progressing well. I mean, she was an old-fashioned girl and we had just kissed at the end of the last date, but that's the way I like them, really, and you couldn't expect more of a woman from her time. Women from my time are too pushy, and I like old-fashioned courting and romance. A row of faces greeted me at the bottom frame of the mirror to match my presentability, intellect, credit, and interest ratings. But since meeting Jane, I was happy for once to dedicate myself to one person and swiped left to dismiss them all. Taking one final look at myself, I switched the mirror off, grabbed the lab-grown bunch of flowers I purchased earlier that day, and left the house. I waited in line at my local Time Inc. transport office. One day I'll be able to afford my own. Set my destination and sat inside a pod. With my destination pre-programmed, all I had to do was swipe my credit card, sit back, and 20 minutes later, we all know the mantra, 1 minute per decade, I'd be at the door of Jane's favourite restaurant, F. Cook's Traditional Pie Shop. Watching the years fly by, I pulled out a copy of the news summary for the 9th of September 1950 on my retinal implants to read what had happened in the week since I'd last seen Jane. Since the time shift of 21-24, travelling back in time to trade, educate and learn was commonplace. Fraternising with the natives was less acceptable, but many of us did it, flirting with the edge of what was considered legal. As long as you didn't stand out too much or make too much disturbance to time, you could get away with it. The trick was learning to fit in, doing your research and not taking too many chances. Some of us would invent entire alternative lives to explain our partial absence, but these became hard to manage and sometimes would cause more confusion and problems than they were worth. Others, myself included, preferred to just be honest and explain what we were, as crazy as that might sound. Certain periods in history were easy to explain the process to. Fortunately, the 1950s, with its obsession with science fiction, the beginnings of nuclear power, and the start of modern science, was easier to explain it to than most. Even if they didn't fully understand how it was all possible, they could at least grasp the concept. Even though I found Jane old-fashioned, for many of her time she was progressive and not entirely at home in her own time. Many like her welcomed the opportunity to meet people who were also not of their time. Sadly, because of the time paradox, people could only ever travel backwards, but never forwards, creating an even more complex web of privilege in the world.
My journey drawing to an end, I could slowly see the 1950s London streets drawing into view, along with the smoke and grubbiness that accompanied them. I left the pod, and it blended into the surroundings to await my return, and wandered the three streets to the restaurant. Even with my attempts to blend in, I knew I stood out. Something about my general look. People in the past were generally more gaunt. They smoked more, ate less healthily, optimized their bodies less than those of us from the 2150s. Turning the corner to the restaurant, I stopped to take a breath and relax my fluttering heart before entering. I scanned the room for Jane and couldn't see her yet, but made my way to the table we met at last time. I sat and glanced at the menu, but already knew what I wanted. I looked forward to my fill of beef pie and mash every week. It's nothing like the food from my time. A handful of indeterminate minutes passed, where I was lost in my thoughts, and Jane surprised me with her sudden presence. She always did this. To me, a soul from the 2150s, the 1950s was sensory overload at the best of times. So much noise, so many smells, so much texture. My senses were overloaded by her perfume, the scratching noises, smells, and grain of the natural fabrics in her clothes, the loud sound of her shoes, the strange way her hair sat so rigidly in place. That's not to say it was unpleasant, quite the opposite, but it took a few minutes for my senses to settle down. Not that I showed this, of course. Jane, like many home-timers, was always on edge with out-of-timers, paranoid of seeming stupid or colloquial. I calmed my jittery senses and stood to greet her with a small peck on the cheek. She blushed and looked guiltily to the floor, which, of course, made her look more stunning. Oh, stop looking at me like that. You're embarrassing me, she gushed.
You like it, don't you? I retort, with cheek in my voice.
Well, of course I do, she bashfully whispered under her breath. But it simply isn't the done thing, you know that.
Well, I can't help my out-of-time ways, can I? I respond, not regretting a thing I'd done, of course. I love drinking in this sensory delight.
The waitress appeared and took our order. This whole ordering process of the past still fascinates me. Such an inefficient idea. You wait for one person to take your order, then they go and tell someone else what it is, someone else prepares it, and someone brings it back again. Then, if you want more, you deal with the whole merry dance again, and when you want to pay, off you go again. So many people for such a small thing. Of course, in the 2150s, the bots take care of everything. While we wait for our food, we make small talk. I hand over the flowers. She blushes some more. I ask her about the week's events I read on my way here. She asks me about my week. We hold hands under the table and stare into each other's eyes, and I drink in the warmness of the whole scene. Our food arrives. We eat. Another sensory experience I relish. Food in my time is functional. Pills and potions that provide you with just the nutrition you need as efficiently as possible, but with no fun or pleasure. Food from the 1950s is all just so damn heavy. I think they used the words stodgy and rich, such glorious words you would never even think of in the 2150s. It's so full of flavors, textures, and yes, I know, so full of ingredients that are bad for your body, especially a body like mine, not used to such wasteful junk like sugar, fat, wheat, dairy, and meat. Even if we had animals left that were worth eating, it seems such an impossible concept to me, but here was everyone around me eating dead creatures. Crazy. Jane doesn't like to talk while she's eating. She likes to retain as much grace as possible, and that requires concentration. I, on the other hand, am still enjoying this novelty and am barely used to using cutlery. So shove food into my mouth, hit my teeth with the fork, nearly stab myself in the face with the knife, drop crumbs on the floor, and generally embarrass myself. Thankfully, she loves that and makes laughing eyes at me the whole time. We finish our food and she orders tea, something people in the 1950s seem to continuously consume. Again, so much wonderful waste. It's a hot, murky-colored liquid filled with dairy and some odd sort of dried leaf thing. I'm not used to hot liquids, so always attempt to drink it too quickly, nearly burning my mouth. Again, a sensory experience I should shy away from, but when you're used to feeling next to nothing, every experience is glorious. Full of food, she relaxes back into her chair. I can sense she's going to bring up the subject she often brings up when she sees me. I miss you sorely every week. Can't you come more often? I know...
I cut her off, knowing where this conversation is going. Sorry, Jane. As I already explained, it's simply not possible at the moment. I have a job in my home time, responsibilities... I could look into applying for an ERA reporter job, but I'm not qualified. I could... I stopped myself before I finished the sentence. As much as I'd love to stay here in the 1950s with sweet, sweet Jane, I wonder what living out of time would be like. And besides, currently staying out of time permanently is reserved for a select few. She sits forward, resigned but understanding. There have been whispers recently of changes to the time laws. Some of us are hoping that this might mean they become more relaxed. There are rumors that factions representing our interests are growing, but it's just rumors. Until then, we're going to have to keep things the way they are, I'm afraid. Jane sits further forward, drops my hand from under the table, and gives me a look I have never seen on her face before, and it shocks me. Somewhere between resentment and... victory.
You're damn right things are going to change, she says in a tone and manner I've never heard from her before. We've had enough of people from your time flitting around the timeline like a flock of locusts, causing disruption whenever you go. Her look turns to disgust. In my time, we look back on you with disbelief. How could you all be so reckless in the past, with no consideration for the impact you're causing?
I lean back, lost for words and shocked. We...
That's right. Only ever thinking of yourselves. That's the problem with your time. You use the time schism to profit financially and emotionally.
Jane takes on a particularly disgusted expression when she mentions these last words.
In the 2260s, we've decided to put a stop to all of you time wasters. Hunt you, make you learn to respect time and the people and events in it.
She grabs my hand again, but this time forcefully, with a firm grip.
We're leaving,
she says.
Now pay for our meals and let's leave like nothing happened. Just two old-timers having lunch together.
She grips me by the hand as I fumble in my pockets for replica 1950s pounds and hand them over. I drop them on the counter as she pulls me out of the restaurant. But where are you taking me? I stammer. I can't go to your time due to the paradox. She pulls me harder down a dark alley.
Don't you worry. Where I'm from, we have the perfect solution for people like you, where you can do no harm to anyone or any time.
She forces me into a corner, and I catch one final glance at her beautiful face. A face I so look forward to seeing. A face I adored and would have spent the rest of my life with had it been possible. Jane pushes a button and a pod appears out of the background. She pushes me into the dark, cold portal.
Enjoy stasis!
She shouts as the door closes behind me, and I catch one last breath of the sights, smells, and sounds of 1950s London. This story is On Eurocriticon by Susie Carlick.
Mo. Alfred Maury, 1817 to 1892, was a French physician and scholar known for his work related to the interpretation of dreams and the effect of external stimuli on same. His theories predate those of Sigmund Freud, and he coined the term hypnagogic hallucination. He was born at Meaux, a commune in the metropolitan region of Paris, France. Meaux is at the same time a village in the unincorporated area of Vermilion Parish, Louisiana. Although undocumented, one can deduce that somewhere nearby was born Huey P. Meaux, died 2007, an American record producer born in Louisiana in 1929. At the age of 67, he was charged, sentenced, and jailed for 15 years for committing a variety of pedophilic acts, none of which are legal in any country on earth. Nicknamed the Crazy Cajun, he produced popular songs such as Wasted Days and Wasted Nights by Freddie Fender.
De deux mieux, il fait choisir la moindre.
It takes two to tangle.
Maury believed external stimuli to be the catalyst to dreams. It was a particular dream Maury dreamt that suggested to him dreams came about so quickly they occurred almost simultaneously with the stimulus that had produced them. Maury was a contemporary of Marie-Jean-Léon Lecoq, the Marquis d'Hervé Saint-Denis, also a researcher of dreams. Maury's inspiring dream was that he had been condemned to the guillotine. As the blade fell, he woke up to find the top of his bed had fallen and hit him in the spine at the exact time the guillotine would have struck him. Although the guillotine, it should be pointed out, would have struck him in the neck.
Physical unpleasantness gets the upper hand, admits the Marquis.
Maury's pioneering studies of the psychology of the unconscious mind remain important, not only because they cast doubt on the reliability of Catholic ideas, but also for the way they refracted growing bourgeois anxiety about the escalating threat of revolution from France's dangerous classes.
Because of the logical line of dream action, Maury hypothesized that the dream is generated backwards by the arousing stimulus.
The Marquis d'Hervé de Saint-Denis believed the exact opposite. That is, that dreams are the product of internal experience, and the dangerous classes were therefore the only classes worth considering. He was not, however, at all in disagreement with sending Maury to the guillotine.
According to Maury, but not the Marquis, dreams are created only upon wakening. Id est, one dreams one's dreams.
The two dream researchers spent many years in bitter disagreement.
De deux mots, il faut choisir le moindre.
The Kekulé ring.
The German chemist Friedrich August Kekulé was, by many accounts, neither a particularly good practical chemist nor an inspiring teacher. He is known for his solution to the problem of the structure of benzene, C6H6. Kekulé suggested that the structure of benzene contained a six-membered ring of carbon atoms with alternating single and double bonds.
The Berichte der Dürstingen Chemischen Gesellschaft, a parody of the Berichte der Deutschen Chemischen Gesellschaft, ran a humorous depiction of benzene. This was back in a time when the sciences were as viciously competitive as politics today.
Kekulé twice shared the process by which he came to his discovery. He had earlier told of a waking dream on a London bus in which he had seen atoms grouping themselves together in space. In a second recount of the story, however, he mentions a daydream of a snake eating its own tail.
The Berichte der Dürstigen Chemischen Gesellschaft parody had monkeys seizing each other's tails in a circle, rather than Kekulé's Ouroboros. The Berichte der Dürstigen Chemischen Gesellschaft was Kekulé's nemesis, as Moret was the Marquis d'Hervé's de Saint-Denis. But who among this monkey ring is the dreamer, and who is the dreamed?
Apart from his benzene discovery, Kekulé's remaining contributions to chemistry were mostly theoretical and speculative, born of reverie or hypnagogia.
The borderland of sleep. Hypnagogia, Greek hypnos, the root found in argo, to lead away, conduct, convey, agogius, conveyor, abduction, transport, leading away, etc., is the mental state of someone who is moving towards sleep or wakefulness, but has not yet completed the transition.
To be carried away on the current of dreams, of reverie perfumed and soft, the pillows of my vessel heave by waves of fantasy carried aloft.
Hypnagogia can be induced by a dream machine, which emits light pulsing at a frequency close to that of alpha waves to create this effect. Descriptions of exceptionally vivid and elaborate hypnagogic visuals can be found in the work of the Marquis d'Hervé de Saint-Denis.
In his De Divinatione per Somnum, Aristotle states, dream presentations are analogous to the forms reflected in water.
Among the more commonly reported and more thoroughly researched sensory features of hypnagogia are phosphenes, which can manifest as seemingly random speckles, lines, or geometrical patterns, including form constants. They may be monochromatic or richly colored, still or moving, flat or three-dimensional.
A body of water never moves. Waves are not the build and collapse of oceans, the entropy of seas. Rather, energy moves through bodies of water. Tiny waves in a single human cell are the same tides of energy that travel the seas.
Form constants.
A form constant is one of several geometric patterns which are recurringly observed during hallucinations and altered states of consciousness.
What has not been set on fire by my eyes takes the most fantastic and unreasonable forms. The Marquis d'Hervé de Saint-Denis.
It is believed that the reason these form constants appear lies in how the visual system is organized and, in particular, the mapping between patterns on the retina and the columnar organization of the primary visual cortex. Concentric circles in the retina are mapped into parallel lines in the visual cortex. Spirals, tunnels, lattices, and cobwebs map into lines in different directions.
The space in between dreams, like the space in between the organs of a body, at once tiny and vast, dark and light, concentric mazes of circles, heat the red of light, the weight of dreams at night.
The diversity of conditions that provoke such patterns suggests that form constants reflect some fundamental property of visual perception, similar to the way water expands in rings.
Hypnagogia again, but really, Eigenlicht. Hypnagogia has been described as an in-between state, that is, a state of being in between. Researchers refer specifically to that period when a dreamer moves from fractal imagery or form constants to dreaming narratives, i.e., from simple Eigenlicht to whole imagined scenes.
The cities and fields of our semi-conscious minds are called into being by a sacrifice to light. The ancient and futuristic ritual of calling forth the dark to wander through half-illumined alleyways, dusk-filled streets, wild velds of half-night that exist just beyond the border that reality patrols.
Eigenlicht, intrinsic light, dark light or brain grey, is perceived as lighter than a black object in normal lighting conditions because contrast is more important to the visual system than absolute brightness. For example, the night sky looks darker than Eigenlicht because of the contrast provided by the stars.
Magnetic systems in time and brain space. A possible physical explanation for hypnagogia is rooted in the discovery of magnetite crystals in cells of the brain and meninges. It has been found that there are 5 million magnetite crystals per gram in the human brain and 20 times that number in the meninges. These biomagnetite crystals are oriented in the brain in a manner that maximizes their magnetic moment, thus allowing the crystals to act as a system and marking the ability of the brain to sense energy fields.
In quantum physics, unitarity means that the sum of probabilities of all possible outcomes of any event is always, has always been, and will always be, one.
Einstein showed that if time and space are measured using electromagnetic phenomena, like light bouncing between mirrors or phosphenical movement, then, due to the constancy of the speed of light, time and space become mathematically entangled together in a certain way which, in turn, results in the entanglement of all other important derivative physical quantities, like energy, momentum, mass, force, etc.
Wo es war, soll ich werden.
In short, all of time and space, both within the brain and without, is tangled up in itself.
The Grand Tangle. In link theory, a tangle is an embedding of n arcs and m circles into r to the power of 2 times a set of 0 and 1. The difference from an alternate mathematical definition is that it includes circles as well as arches and partitions the boundary into two isomorphic pieces, which is algebraically more convenient, allowing one to add tangles by stacking them, for instance.
In ancient Greece, dream pilgrimages were a common route to curing bodily ailments. What is the route of a pilgrimage of dreams? Is it straight, narrow, wide, circular? Does each turn touch upon another, fecklessly entangling the paths of dreamers, like a scribble on a wall?
In common speech, tangle finds its roots in the mid-14th century and is a nasalized variant of tagelen, to involve in a different situation, entangle. From a Scandinavian source, dialectical Swedish tagla, to disorder, pongal, seaweed. The meaning to fight with is American English, first recorded in 1928. De deux mots, il fait choisir le monde.
Water expands in rings that kiss the next one into being, carrying its reflected forms to the farthest shores, touching light and dark, phosphenes and Eigenlicht, each to the other and the other to all, like a vast and undulating mirror, like a tangle of dark and light.
You've been listening to Stories About People with Susie Karlick and Chris Ward. Written, recorded and produced in Berlin. Find out more at storiesaboutpeople.science.